sitting at my table.
Dignity.
Security.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
Like
Equality.
Equality.
Remedy. And protection.
Fairness.
Fair time.
Right.
Well,
peace.
Movement.
This is my mistake. Let me make it good. I raised the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum.
Identity.
Family.
Home.
Conscience.
Expression.
Expression. Expression.
Expression.
Participation.
Democracy.
Welfare.
Work.
Work.
Leisure.
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 Health.
Education.
Focus.
Culture.
Human rights.
Charter Dana.
Solidarity.
Responsibility.
Fill in the mortar. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM and over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on Sastel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 700. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. My name is Jim Hutchings, and we have a number of guests today to talk about co-housing, more specifically Prairie Spruce Commons, a local Regina co-housing project. From the Regina group, we have Dave LaRue and Suzanne Sauter, and on the phone we have Chris Scott Hansen. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you, Greg.
Hello, Jim. How are you?
I am well. Okay, so you're going to hear me. They'll hear you, but they can't talk to you. So
okay.
If they have any thoughts to pass on, they can write me notes or something, something like that.
Okay.
So I'll be talking to them in the second half of the show, and we'll be primarily talking with you in the first half of the show.
Okay.
All righty. So I think the main question we want to ask here for our listeners is, what is co-housing and how does it differ from the usual condominium developments that we hear so much about?
Well, I can answer the general question, and Dave can answer the specific question about Prairie Spruce Commons, because he does that so often and so well. Generally, what co-housing is a movement worldwide to create community more intentionally while preserving the privacy of the single-family home. So people are creating condominium projects generally. They're not always condominiums, but mostly. And they share common facilities, which is a little different, and create an atmosphere where they encourage community. Sharing common facilities, segregating cars, encouraging children, play areas, shared workshop space, shared places to have meals periodically. All are things to encourage community, and the community is designed intentionally to create those kinds of situations.
Okay, Chris, and I'm just curious then, what is you're obviously not here, you're someplace else. What is your role with co-housing?
I've been working at housing development since the mid-70s, and starting in 1989, I've worked exclusively with co-housing groups, helping them make their dreams come true. As a development consultant, I assist them in finding land, setting up a relationship with the banks, the developers, the contractors, the architects, the engineers, and the planners, and arranging all the pieces of the development puzzle on behalf of the co-housing group that intends to live in the project.
Okay, so did you sort of all of a sudden decide that you're going to do this, or did you sort of gradually move into this area from sort of regular housing development?
Well, I was doing regular housing development consulting through 88, and starting in 89, I saw the co-housing book that came out in 88, and I thought, wow, this is exactly what I've been wanting to create. And so I basically retired from my work and created a project at Winslow Co-Housing west of Seattle on an island. And that was my first project in 89-90. And that's all I've done ever since.
Okay, so you were at a point where you could take a flyer and see how it went.
Exactly. I was kind of done with being a development consultant. I was tired of all the permit processing and all that stuff, and that's what I'd been doing for a few years back in the 80s, and I was ready to do something that was more meaningful, and co-housing fell in my lap in December of 88.
Well, December of 88, that's a few years ago, so co-housing has been on the move for quite a while then.
Yes, the co-housing book, the original book done by McCammon Durrett, came out in the summer of 88, and a friend of mine handed it to me in December of 88 and said, Chris, I think this is what you've been talking about. And she was right, and it changed the course of my life from that day on.
Wow. Okay, so are there many people like yourself? Like, how much has co-housing sort of developed over the years here since 88? Is it something that's really taken off, or something that's sort of grown slowly?
It's grown slowly. There are 150 or so co-housing projects in North America, all across the U.S. and Canada. I was involved in some of the early projects and assisted people in learning how to do the development process. And now there are people like myself who facilitate the development of co-housing in British Columbia and in Toronto and Washington, D.C. and Denver and kind of all over the place, California.
Okay, so what would your main role be then? People sort of get the co-housing bug and decide that it's something they want to explore, and they don't know quite how to go about it. What sort of things do you do to help them make it happen?
Well, the first thing the group asked me to do was to assist them in deciding on some property, because they were interested in finding land in Regina that would work. And they told me what they thought they wanted, and then we did some mapping, and they figured out what areas they preferred to be in. And I came up and assessed the situation locally and determined that the development industry and the construction industry in the area was challenging enough for the newcomer, a co-housing group being a newcomer to development, because these people have never done development themselves. I recommended that they not try to be their own developer, that they try to partner with a developer. They agreed with the concept and asked me to find them some alternatives, and so I started talking to and having lunch with various developers in the Regina area. I certainly didn't meet all the developers in the area, but I met a number of them and caught the interest of several, and we had a couple to choose from, and we decided to work with Vince and Joe Fiorente of Fiorente Homes and Commercial, who have a project, a piece of land and a project that fits our needs, and the group was very happy to take them as a partner and work on creating a project for themselves there.
Would I be right in suggesting that perhaps you get some interest from developers from the point of view of doing something completely different from what they've been used to.
Yes, developers do tend to be interested. What we found in Vancouver back in the early 90s was that when the housing market was hot, the developers were all telling me, we can't afford to spend any time figuring out how to do co-housing because there's money to be made creating housing for these folks leaving Hong Kong. So we're gonna make housing as fast as we can make housing until 97, and then we'll start thinking about co-housing. And that really is kind of what happened in Vancouver, is the housing market was so hot that nobody focused on co-housing until after the transition that happened in 97. After that, several developers started taking on co-housing because they thought it was interesting, and it was certainly a structure that they found fascinating and were willing to take on and try out.
I was having a little bit of a discussion with Dave and Suzanne here before the show, and I suggested to them that if somebody was interested in making a lot of money, co-housing is probably not the direction they'd go in.
If that's a question, I think the answer to that question is yes, that's true. The reason is that the housing industry is used to a much more streamlined, product-oriented process where it's like making and bottling ketchup. I mean, you make huge batches of ketchup, you create these bottles, and you put the ketchup in the bottles, you put a label on it, and then you sell it at the supermarket. And much like a product, housing has historically been done that way. You don't get the people who are going to consume the ketchup in the factory helping you determine what's going to go into the ketchup recipe. And that all gets messy in the development industry. And while it's interesting and challenging and fun, it's not one for making a whole lot of profit, generally speaking. The developers have to be really motivated to take this on, and there has to be a financial return for them to make it worthwhile.
It does sound complicated. It does sound complicated. So what is it that makes these things happen then? You seem to have quite a few impediments in front of you. If somebody wants to buy a home or build a home, this really doesn't seem like a simple way to do it. So why would they bother?
I think the simple answer to that question is one word, and that's community. These people are looking for some community in their life. They're looking for an alternative to the separation and isolation of a single-family detached home. They're looking for a way to have their own privacy, but walk out the front door into a community that they know and care about, with people that they feel close to and comfortable with and have a relationship with. So the answer to your question is it's community.
So how does this unfold in a co-op, rather in co-housing? How do you develop neighborhood or the sort of things that go on in co-housing?
Well, there's two phases. There's the development process, finding land, planning the project, figuring out the budget and the schedule and the cash flow plan, doing the design, agreeing to everything, and creating the project, creating something you can purchase and move into. More importantly is the second phase, which is moving in and seeing the neighbors that were part of your co-housing community, people that you cared about and spent a lot of time with and met with and did all kinds of workshops and meetings with over the years as you created the community. And when you move in, you have those people living in the same building, down the hall, upstairs, downstairs. You see them in the common house. You do potlucks with them. You have all kinds of other activities that you create as a community. And you see those folks on a regular basis. And that's where the real community building starts.
Well, it certainly sounds like a complete departure from say, moving into a condominium or an apartment where you have no idea who your neighbors are, and 5 years later you still have no idea who your neighbors are.
Yeah, that's a good example. Exactly right. Normally, housing is a product that you purchase, and most people purchase their housing product in a used form. It's not new. So you're buying something that's a known quantity. It's like buying a used car. There may be some things about it you like and some things about it you don't like. But what it rarely ever comes with is a very large dose of community. With co-housing, you're choosing something up front that has a community piece to it, to the design, to the plan, to the intention. And that's the big choice that's being made, is to create some community for themselves.
I'm just curious, I mean, like, as we talk about this, I mean, it sounds wonderful, but it also sounds complex. Dave, do you ever have any projects that don't quite make it to completion?
Are you asking me?
Yep.
yes, we have had. There are some sad examples. One in New York City that happened in January, February of 2009, when the banking industry collapsed.
Oh.
We had a project that was ready for financing and ready to, we should have been under construction by summer or early fall of 2009, and nobody would finance the construction because all the banks shut down their construction lending arms, and we just couldn't go forward. I had another project years ago on Vashon Island where the group spent a couple of years planning the project and ended up finding out that the state water rights process was going to take almost 10 years.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
Just to get water rights. And they decided, I mean, they could have hung on for 10 years. There was a plan to possibly do that, but they eventually decided to walk away from the project because they just decided they didn't want to wait 10 years for water rights.
Yeah.
So those things do happen sometimes, but that's like anything in the development industry. There are hurdles, and sometimes pretty big hurdles that you have to jump.
Yeah, those sound like pretty extreme, exceptional hurdles.
Can be. Mm-hmm.
So your experience then has been that, generally speaking, when you get a group together, once they understand what's going on, they stick it out, and you end up with a project being built.
Well, if the group sticks together, that's generally what happens. I mean, there are things that get in the way sometimes, but generally the power is in the group staying together and committing to one another that they're going to make their project happen.
Well, I have heard of co-housing before and been in on some discussions about what it was all about. And one of the issues that they talked about was what happens when the inevitable happens and people get to a point where they can't stay there anymore, or perhaps they get a job someplace else and they have to move, and now they have to sell their share in the co-housing project. How complicated is that?
Well, more often than not, there's an interest group that's interested in the community that participates from afar. They don't live in the community, but they share evening meals once a week. They go to potlucks or something, and they do social events with the community. They stay on a list of interested people, and they become the first potential buyers for units to become available. That, to the extreme, there's a co-housing community in Massachusetts that has a number of people on the waiting list who have bought houses next door to their project because they wanted to stay close in case a unit became available so they could buy it and move in. Other groups don't maintain their contact list and have a little bit harder time, and then they have to go through a real sales process. But generally speaking, it's fairly smooth. It's all done word of mouth, and people find people who are interested in community to buy the units when they become available.
Well, that's interesting. I would have thought that you would have a problem there, but if somebody is thinking ahead, and it really doesn't sound like it would be that much of a problem. You maintain that people list of people who are interested, and then when the time comes, it's almost happens naturally.
For most groups, not all, but for most groups, that is the way it happens.
Wow. And I would suppose that would be one of the things that you as a consultant would emphasize, that if they don't want to have this problem X number of years down the road, here's how you get around it. And it would basically only mean sort of extending your community group just a little further than the bounds of your own project, which should be a natural sort of thing to happen anyway.
And I think it will be especially natural for Prairie Spruce Commons because their location is so central. It's such a desirable location. And I think there's going to be a lot of interest in the neighborhood and in the area, in the community close by, to stay in touch with the housing community at Prairie Spruce. And I think there'll be a waiting list long term after the group moves in.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised myself. I have an idea of where it's going to be built, and you're right up against the park and downtown. You're not far from, the art center. I don't know what things that would you want to go to that you couldn't walk to from there.
Well, it's a fairly easy walk to right downtown, and it's close, very close to the hospital and all the commercial activities that are available. And of course, there's the ice rink right across the alleyway. So,
well, I'm really, like I say, personally, I'm impressed with the whole concept, and you're actually making it sound like you've got a pretty good a roadmap of things that need to happen, and you're probably avoiding problems before they pop up for the most part.
Well, that's the idea. That's what we hope to do. What I warn groups about when they hire me in the first place is that when somebody like myself gets involved that's done dozens of these projects, your project starts to happen, and it's no longer a ride down the exploratory path of talking about it. It becomes a sometimes much more bumpy ride, but it's a more exciting ride, I think, down the path of developing a project you're actually going to get built and move into.
How many of these projects do you think you've done since 1988?
Well, I lost track at 35. I think it must be up close to 40. I've been involved in one way or another, from land acquisition and project planning all the way through to total project management. So a lot of different projects, a lot of different parts of the project.
Do you maintain communications with them? With a lot of them, as time goes on, or you're pretty well. There's no need. They've got the skills needed to keep things going. Or do you get sort of callbacks from time to time?
I don't get callbacks for my work because my work is very front end oriented. My work is oriented towards getting the project built. But I do develop a lot of friendships and relationships with people who live in these projects, and I have friends in Boston and Vermont and Kansas and California and all over the place.
So my sort of final question here, I'm just curious, is this a concept that's mostly a North American one, or is it done more worldwide?
Well, what I know, and I'm not an expert to answer that question from firsthand, but secondhand knowledge is that it's started in Europe, in Northern Europe, in Denmark. It grew into a lot of northern countries in Europe, certainly Denmark, Sweden. I know there are several projects in the UK. And then it jumped the pond, and it started in North America, and their early projects were in the U.S. and Western Canada. And there are now also projects in Australia and New Zealand. So.
Well, thanks very much, Chris. Really enjoyed your conversation And I'm going to carry on here after the break with David and Suzanne. But thanks very much for being with us, and hopefully we'll have an opportunity to talk to you again sometime in the future.
You're very welcome, Jim. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
1, 2, 3, uh-huh.
And that was Michael Franti, Sound of Sunshine. And whenever I'm wondering what to play for music, I always think, Michael Franti. You can't go wrong with Michael Franti. Well, now we're going to talk with Suzanne and Dave, who are involved intimately with the Prairie Spruce Commons co-housing project. I was hoping you might have been able to talk to Chris, but... This is a whole new territory we're going down, uncharted territory. So, yeah, as it turned out, Chris could hear me, but not you. But now everyone can hear you. So I just wanted to ask you folks something, you know, some more specific things specific to Prairie Spruce. And I guess my first question would be, how long has this been in the works? When did it start? What was its genesis? And were you guys in at the very beginning, or...?
Our family was. There were four families in it at the very beginning.
And that would have gone back probably almost 3 years ago. And it was an idea at the time. A number of us were looking for a sense of community. We were looking for a better place to live. And it's not like we weren't happy. I mean, we've lived where we are for 30-plus years, right? Mm-hmm. So you do get to know the neighbors. And my wife was involved in a lot of canvassing for charities and whatever. So a lot of conversation going on. But I'm not sure that that's what happens so much these days, right? And we know that eventually we're going to be moving, downsizing, or whatever. So we were looking for a better community for ourselves and family members. And so we participated in a visioning exercise that was facilitated by a local community-based organization. There's not just the four families, there were others as well. But that's kind of, at the end of that, somebody says, you know, this sounds an awful lot like co-housing. And I had no idea what co-housing was, but we started looking. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, you're right, this is co-housing. And so we went on from there.
Wow. So this was, it didn't really start off be called co-housing as far as this visioning group was concerned.
No, they just talked about what they wanted, you know, and what they were looking for, and some, fortunately for us, there were the facilitators or other people in the group had an idea what co-housing was. Like, we didn't start out saying, oh, we want to do co-housing.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
interesting.
So, yeah.
So, Suzanne, you were involved at the beginning as well.
Well, I came on board probably 2.5 years ago. Dave and the initial group of families had, I think, grown. They captured one new member just from word of mouth, and they decided to go on radio, and I heard an interview. I heard part of an interview on CBC Radio, and the piece that I heard was all about a sustainable building and this really energy-efficient building that they were going to be part of co-housing, which essentially is what co-housing is. It's community, and it's also a quality building, and hopefully will make a smaller ecological footprint for each of us. So, and that was mm-hmm. where my passion was I was fortunate. My late husband was a carpenter. He built a very energy-efficient home way back in the mid-'80s, and it's too much for me. Mm-hmm. Four adult children now weigh, so I had a large house and a large yard. Energy-efficient though it was more than I needed. And I was just waiting for something to come along that would reflect the green initiatives that I saw in my house that could be in something else. And I did not see that in the larger Regina construction. And so that was the piece that I heard, and I thought, well, this meeting's coming up. I'm going to go to this meeting. And I had to go through quite some channels to figure out where it was because I missed that part too. But I did. I connected there, and that was my first experience of the word co-housing. I didn't know what co-housing was. I didn't catch that piece, and I'm not even sure if the interviewer at that time referred to it as co-housing or co-op housing, because there's confusion sometimes. So it was a slow process for me as, you know, going to some meetings and meeting these people that wanted this community, and I wasn't sure that was for me. But you know what? We met, we had potlucks, and we worked together, and it just felt right. The community, I saw how important the community was, especially for myself, currently, you know, living by myself in mm-hmm. a large house, and this built-in support system and just friendships that had grown. And so, yeah, that's kind of how I got involved.
So there's a number of interesting facets to it. We're talking about, you say, quality building. How far down the road are we saying this building is going to exist? Like, a lot of buildings today are built with a 20-year window. They plan on tearing down the building in 20 years after they build it.
Well, we took the initiative to hire actually a sustainable consultant to help us define what we wanted as far as green initiatives and sustainability. And so Sarah McCraven from Beetle Green, I understand is the name of the company, she did some sessions with us, and we talked about, you know, sustainability and all the mm-hmm. different aspects, and also, you know, as far as when you build, if it is going to only have a 20-year lifespan, then okay, are those items recyclable, or are they mm-hmm. going to go back to the earth? Like the long term, I'm sure our building is going to be very well built and will mm-hmm. be around for a lot more than 20 years. Some of the things that we're looking at doing is a very tight, well-insulated envelope, but, you know, extra thicker walls with more insulation. And we're having as much passive solar as we can. Because of the orientation of our piece of land, we can't actually maximize that. But the architects, Pattison MGM right here in the city, have done an excellent job. We had that part of the process, part of the community building, was meeting with the architects, having like day-long weekend sessions actually with the architects to define what are the elements within this building that are important to us, what do we need to accommodate community as well as have our own private space. So yeah, it's been a lot of community building and a lot of work. And yeah, the 2.5 years, it some days seems like an eternity, and other days, like Dave said, well, when did we hire Chris? And I'm thinking, I don't know. He seemed to have been around forever now, but it's probably only a year. But things have really been moving again since we got our consultants on board.
Wow. At what point did you get an architect involved? I'm just curious.
We couldn't do that until we had the land, of course, right? So as soon as we had land, we had an option on land because we're partnering with the developer, as Chris suggested. The land is owned by the developer, and so they gave us an option. So they were kind enough to hold it for us as we were going through a design phase. And so it was probably early year, like maybe February or something like that, we started the design process.
Did you have any trouble finding an architect?
Well, our first desire was to find an architect that was familiar with co-housing, because there are intentional design aspects there that foster interaction in the community and whatever, right? And we were lucky enough to find in Pattison MGM, they had a recruit or a young man, and his wife had moved to Regina, and he had actually worked for McCannum and Durant that Chris was referring to, which is another group of co-housers down in the States. So we jumped on that right away. We thought that was a good lead, and so I think we were very lucky to find that locally.
Wow.
And I mean, he's not doing it all, but he's doing a lot of the work. His name is Chris as well, and but they're a team there at Pattison MGM, and they've been really good to us and going the extra mile to help us get where we want to go. And but again, you know, this is all part of our community building process. Participating in the design, it's exciting. It's a lot of work. But we're getting something that we want, right? And I think that's what distinguishes co-housers from just a regular condominium association, right?
Right.
And this goes back to what Chris was talking about, you know, the profitability. He was talking about the bottled ketchup. Well, we're defining the bottles, and we're defining the ketchup, and we're defining everything, right? So when you do things that one of like that, you know, you don't get the repeatability necessarily, right?
Right. So this would be probably a different process for the architects. They're usually probably designing something to show, but you're telling the architect what you want.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a give and take. I mean, I think they probably, and I don't know because I haven't done this before, they probably have customers that say, I want to build a house and design it, so work with me on this. But, you know, a lot of it is ready-built product, right? And so the developer will work with the architect and say, I want something that's this, and, you know, and takes advantage of economies of scale and repeatability, so they stack the designs and whatever, right? They do what they can to keep the costs low.
Yeah, I'm just wondering whether maybe the architect would find this a little bit frustrating because he'd have a lot of players to deal with instead of one or two.
That's a very good observation. You know, we've probably had anywhere from 15 to 20 people involved, you know, at one time through the design process. So it's the architects, there's a lot of care and feeding of the group. But our group has certain processes in place that facilitate that, because we use a consensus decision-making model. We can talk some more about that if you want, but it's part of the culture, and it makes it as least painful as possible, I think.
Well, let's talk about that then.
Okay.
What does that process entail?
Well, it's a consensus model, meaning everybody's opinion matters, right? Mm-hmm. So things definitely take a bit longer as you sample everyone's opinion, right? But you end up with a better decision at the end because everyone has contributed to it. In theory, one person could block a decision, right? But they can't block a decision and walk away. Mm-hmm. If you block, and you have to have good reasons, it can't be just personal, oh, I don't like that. It's got to be what's good for the community. And somebody might say, you know, that's not good for the community.
Right.
And so they'll highlight that, and then they'll explain why. And they'll be involved in improving the proposal or improving the decision. So they have to be participatory at that from going forward, mm-hmm. so that it's not something that someone wants to block.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you have anybody walk away?
Walk away from the beginning?
Sort of start up and then just decide, no, I can't do this.
We have. But each person has different reasons. Mm-hmm. It is work. I mean, I'd be kidding you if I said it's not work. It mm-hmm. is. So the passion that we have for this whole notion of community and our personal circumstance drives us forward, and that keeps us motivated as well. And so there's an economic factor sometimes where people have to walk away. There's a time commitment that some people have to walk away. There's different things, right? Somebody might have a change in family circumstance mm-hmm. that means it's no longer appropriate
or job,
for them.
Something like that.
Exactly, yeah. Right. So
did you have very much of that, or like the attrition for various reasons?
We've definitely had, you know, people come and go. We've had people come and go and then come back again, you know, because as time or circumstances change. But nobody's ever walked away because they didn't like what we were doing. Everybody says, well, we love what you're doing, but these are the reasons, you know, that mm-hmm. we can't. Mm-hmm. So that speaks well. One thing I wanted to add with this consensus decision making is just the good feel that permeates the community and permeates those meetings. We've had people, we invite people to become associate members, just to get a taste of what we're about. That costs $100 and it's 3 months, and you can come to any events, meetings, and people come to those meetings and they just are overwhelmed with sort of almost harmony. But I mean, everybody mm-hmm. says their piece, but that's the thing. I remember my first few meetings, you know, having to really bite my tongue because I'd already made up my mind on what should be done, right? Mm-hmm. We don't need to listen to all this or you know,
right.
And some people are saying the same thing. So that was a really learning practice for me because it goes against what the outside culture does, right? The people that have the loudest voice sometimes say, and mm-hmm. then you vote.
Right.
Whereas this way, it's everybody gets a chance to say and are given that respect to say and be listened to. So it's such a good feel to be at those meetings. And even when I go, I'm tired. When I go to these meetings, I leave feeling energized because of the meeting and what's happened there.
Kind of like going to church.
Well, you know, we do have a value system. One of the first things we did when we started out was to publish a set of principles. And they're not exhaustive. It's just being respectful, caring, and sharing.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those things, like we put that out there right up front, right? Mm-hmm. There's no religious denomination or affiliation.
Right.
There's no strict ideology. But it's about caring about people and respecting people, right? And that goes a long way to building that community. When Suzanne says, you know, about the vote, when you vote without having this consensus model, you have winners and losers,
mm-hmm,
and you have
mm-hmm.
simmering resentments and
right,
whatever.
Right.
It's unhealthy.
Right.
Well, we don't call it voting. We have consensus, and we have degrees of consensus, but it's no voting.
Mm-hmm.
Unless it's an emergency, then we have some.
So you just sort of reach a point where you figure, well, we can work with this.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you don't worry about something being absolutely the way you would like it.
Right. But I want to emphasize that we don't want too many people that say, oh, I can just live with it,
mm-hmm.
because that's not a good quality decision either.
Right, right.
We want as many people as possible to say, I embrace this, I support this.
Right. Yeah, I can see where that would be necessary.
Yeah.
And realizing anything is evolving. Like we will make mistakes. We can change, right? Like as mm-hmm. we realize, well, that, you know, we did agree with that, but that's not working. So mm-hmm. most of everything, you know, I mean, once the bricks and mortar are in there's going to be certain things we can't change. But as far as how the community works together, that's mm-hmm. that's an evolving process and will change as the community changes and grows.
I was just thinking, there's almost a. It's almost analogous to a certain extent to, you know, barn raising in the old days, you know, pioneer communities, and everybody gets together to do things for everyone else. And in this province, we've got a history of a cooperative movement. And I don't know whether you could really stretch things that far, but to a large extent, we're kind of going in an opposite direction these days. You know, things are are done less cooperatively and more of the rugged individual. So this is, you're kind of swimming upstream on this one a little bit.
We are. We like to call it, it's a small town feel, right? Because I still think you have a lot of that feel, that cooperative approach, right, in the smaller centers, out of necessity, because they don't have the resources to just go by or whatever, right? People have to come to the table and offer their help, their skills, and some and financial and other resources. And this is one of the things I've really enjoyed with our group as it's evolving. We've got people with different levels of expertise in a whole bunch of different areas. Mm-hmm. And it's just nice. It makes you feel secure. You know, Suzanne talked about security, but there are different aspects of security. And just knowing that you're not going it alone is, can be quite soothing and comforting.
Mm-hmm. What do you see as the future here? I'm just curious, would it be possible to have like a city with all kinds of these developments? And so you've got lots of the sort of intimate neighborhoods where everybody knows everybody and helps everybody and cares.
I think our goal, once we've established our community and have built our building, is to become a bit of a showpiece for the local city, right? Mm-hmm. There's one established already in Saskatoon called Wolf Willow, and another one forming in Saskatoon called Radiance, I believe. We're the first one in Regina.
Mm-hmm.
We feel, maybe we're fooling ourselves, but we feel quite strongly that when we have something that's built and where people can come and visit and see what it's about, that we're going to have a lot more interest. Mm-hmm. And as Suzanne says, even when people have left, they still support the concept, right?
Right, yeah.
So I think it's sound.
And it's become more apparent. You hear it all the time that, you know, people are looking for community. That's, you know, that's what keeps people strong and gives them a sense of place. So I can't really say exactly where I've heard it, but different times on the media and different things, you know, how people, that's what people are yearning for is a sense of community.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what I wanted to add too was when we were talking about community, like the design of our building too, I just got an email from a friend in a small town talking about all the work that goes to hold a small town together, and you know, people working at the rink and the community hall and that kind of thing.
Right.
And I'm thinking, that's kind of what our building, like our common house, we'll have a common house where it's a kitchen and a large dining area and different common spaces. But that's the community is going to, that's going to hold us together, and it's going to pull us together because of the work that's involved and also the relationships that will happen because of working within that space too.
I'm just wondering how the costs are going to shake out in the end. Is it going to be considerably more expensive than just going into a regular development?
Well, we've got some factual data in that regard. We have, in our common spaces, we have about 4,100 square feet, which constitutes about 15% of our saleable space.
Okay.
So that's a cost to build that, right?
Sure.
So that adds to the cost. Then when we talk about all our green features, there's a lot more that we have than we've even mentioned, but we've got about another 5% overhead that contributes to that. Now that's a capital cost that will pay for itself in reduced utilities and whatever down the road.
Mm-hmm.
But altogether it's about 20%. So if you were to find a comparable place, location, 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 right?
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
You have to compare it to something else in that same area, which is prime. Then the square footage and what features and make those adjustments. But we're telling people it's about 20% more than what a comparable space.
So we're talking the upfront cost.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but if you sort of amortize it over the long term,
right.
You've got a building that's going to, it's built better. You really don't know how long it's going to last, really. I mean, if you build something properly.
Well, I'm fully expecting this building is going to last a long time. I mean, why wouldn't it? My house has lasted 50 years.
Sure.
I'm expecting this to be a heritage property.
We're looking at the ledge there now.
Yeah.
They're busy doing a little touch-up, but it's been around for 100 years. And we're fully expecting it to be around for another 100.
You know, we're using stronger walls to accommodate our 40 insulation in the walls, our 60 ceilings, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be well-built.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just a couple of the green features that we didn't mention was the gray water recycling. We're going to have the infrastructure put in. Right now, we can't do it legally, mm-hmm. but we're hoping that we'll be a pilot project in the city to have the first kind of community gray water recycling, which will be great. And then we're also going to be solar ready. So, you know, eventually we'll have solar panels up on our roofs. And,
right.
And,
when you say gray water recycling, how are you recycling it?
Well, it would be probably water from laundry and showers and sinks.
Right.
And there would be pipes. We met with a professor at the University of Regina that mm-hmm. got some funding to do gray water recycling, and she's doing a project, Dr. Stephanie Young, mm-hmm. and some of our members have met with her, and she's very interested in working with us to do this. So
I'm just curious about that because I lived through our drought in the 80s, and in Weyburn, they were actually having people, okay, when you're done with your bath, use that to water your garden.
Yep.
you know? Dishwater, sure. Same thing.
Right.
Yeah. You know?
So the recycling part is it has to be treated in some fashion, right? Mm-hmm. You can't just throw soapy water out in the yard in the
city.
We
did.
I know, small town. But it'll be treated to the extent where it'll come back and you'll be used to flush toilets and stuff, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And then re-enter the sanitary sewer system for treatment. So all the plumbing, the redundant plumbing is being put in place so that we can accommodate that.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So some of that is... Part of your 20% is going to be some real innovation.
Right.
We just have a few minutes left here. Let's maybe devote that to telling people how they can get involved should they wish to or find out more.
We have our website, and it's called prairiespruce.com. So prairie, P-R-A-I-R-I-E,
that's a tough word.
Spruce, all one word, .com. So I encourage people to go there. They'll see our links to our Facebook and our Twitter accounts. We're trying to generate buzz in the community, right? We show up at the farmers market twice a week, Wednesdays and Saturdays. We have a booth there. We have regular information events. The next one is August the 19th at the United Way at 7 p.m. And we'll have formal presentation there. And we're going to have a crisp bake-off. Oh. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, the little that I can remember that we're planning on having, like some of our community members are going to bake a fruit crisp, and we're going to have a little contest to see which one, you know,
awesome.
People like best. It's kind of, again, a community building event, and we're also inviting any guests to come bring, if they think they've got that perfect fruit crisp recipe and they want to bring it and share it with us and be part of it, we're just hoping they'll come and do that, but... If they don't want to bring one, just come and taste. It'll be great.
One final question. How close are you now to the level of participation that you want?
We have 11 of 27 units that are sold. So we're always looking for more people. And once we reach a certain threshold, we'll be able to turn sod and start the construction.
So you're well on your way, but you got a ways to go.
Yeah, because everybody's funding their own unit, right? So we can't carry a lot of empty units.
Right, for sure. So you have to make sure that the money's there.
You betcha.
Well, thank you very much, Suzanne and Dave, for coming and talking to us about co-housing. I've sure learned a lot. I'm sure our listeners have learned a lot this morning, actually it's this afternoon. And we're going to have to shut things down as we close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio. We hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. For information on past and upcoming shows, with links to human rights actions and information, go to amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."